Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our live Dhamma broadcast and our nightly Dhamma for those of you here in Hamilton. Tonight I thought to talk about fear. Bhaya. Bhaya in Pali means fear or danger or fearsomeness, terror. Those of you who still dare to turn on the news, I'm sure, are inundated by fear mongering. We call it terrorism. The intentional cultivation of fear in others. Sometimes there are other reasons for, or other goals, but quite often, well, it's quite common now to see this seeming single-minded purpose of psychological warfare or terrorism. The first thing for us to understand about terror and terrorism is that, being psychological warfare, of course, it relies upon the victim. It relies upon the vulnerability of the victim and the sensitivity of the victim. It doesn't work against people who are not afraid. And you know, obviously it seems somewhat trite or simplistic to suggest that part of the solution is to not be afraid, but it's important to understand. It's really important to understand, as a Buddhist, the mechanics of suffering, the mechanics of conflict. As we know, if you go deeply into the meditation practice, even physical pain is only true suffering when you let it upset you. Even physical pain, even true direct physical violence, is only truly successful when the victim is psychologically vulnerable. But terrorism, which seems to usually involve a lot of physical violence, but it's conducted in such a way as to have overwhelming collateral damage psychologically. So, of course, not to minimize the terrible tragedy of death, physical pain that comes from these acts of terror, but to remark upon what makes them so effective. That's how it scares people. And of course, I don't think it's the solution. It's not the entire solution for us to stop being afraid of such things. But it is worth remarking that between being afraid of them and being not afraid of them, not being afraid of or frightened by acts of gross and horrific violence is far preferable to be unshaken, to be impervious. It's far preferable, not just for one's own self, but for one's ability to react properly and to consider the situation wisely. In the Buddhist time, I mean, I can't think of any. Obviously, there were no suicide bombers in the Buddhist time. There were no violent shootings. I can't think of any violent killings of innocent individuals simply for the purpose of cultivating terror or targeting a specific group. Imagine if I thought for a while, I could come up with some. But there are specific acts of terrorism. Mild acts, but give you the general, they still give the general idea of responses and means of coping with or dealing with fear. First of all, about fear in general, we have the Dajjika Sutta, which is a very important sutta, really. Not in terms of having any core value for leading one to enlightenment, but it's very important in creating Buddhist culture and creating a Buddhist outlook on life, because it deals directly with fear and deals directly with the triple gem. There's these three powerful objects of reflection: the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. So the Buddha said, he talked about this war, and he was telling a story about Indra. How Indra said, well, if you're afraid in battle, all the angels fighting against the, whatever the other guys were, the non-angels, asuras they called them, fighting against them. He said, if you're afraid, look at my banner. Look at the Dajjaka, the top of my banner, you'll see the flag. And when you see my standard there and you know that I haven't fallen, it will give you courage and your fear will disappear. And he said, and if you don't look at mine, we'll look at this general and that general and these gods. Look at their banners. And the Buddha said, you know, he can say this all he wants, but truth is, if they look at his banner, maybe the fear will disappear and maybe it won't. Because Indra's not a very good role model. He's not himself free from fear. He's not someone that when you think of him, your mind is calm and you have a good example and a reminder of right and wrong, and example of a pure and unshaken individual who is not afraid of anything to remind you that this is the best way. And he said, but I say to you monks, if you ever are off in the forest and you get afraid, or let's say those of us who are living in society and we're afraid, he said, think of the Buddha. And this is where we actually get these main chants. He said, think of all the qualities of the Buddha. And so if you ever hear Buddhist chanting in the Theravada tradition in any country, they all recite these. Iti piso bhagava arahang samma sambuddho, and so on. He said, or if you don't think about me, think about the Dhamma. If you don't think about the Dhamma, think about the Sangha. So, I mean, not to suggest that that's a solution to terrorism or it's a way for a us to be free from fear of gross physical violence. But on the other hand, as Buddhists and as Buddhist meditators, and even as people who are not Buddhists, but just as meditators, you know, the idea of remembering, the idea of recollecting yourself and remembering the path that we're on, remembering those who have trod the path, remembering the ones who have taught the path, remembering their greatness, their nobility, their freedom from fear, gives us a good grounding and reminds us that fear is not useful, doesn't help us, it makes us a victim. And if we can free ourselves from our reactions, then really terrorism loses a lot of its strength, a lot of its power. So certainly it is part of the solution, I think. But this concept, I mean, this is a key concept in Buddhism, the idea that reactions are the problem. It also applies to terrorists, those who create terror. We create terror because we have goals, we have ambitions, evil goals, evil ambitions, or else evil means, evil intentions, evil minds, evil mind states. We have these inside. You know, when a bully picks on someone weaker than them, when older siblings frighten their younger siblings, when parents scare their children, yell at them, shout at them, raise their fists, or even hit them. All of this is terrorism. I mean, part of it is terrorism. Sometimes it's just the desire to inflict pain. Sometimes it's the desire to frighten. All of this is reaction as well. It's based on reaction. It's based on an inability to be at peace. So, I mean, really the solution, if one can call it that, because there's no question that it's not likely to be successful, not anytime soon. But the work that we do to fix and to solve these problems is to teach. You know, I mean, a lot of terrorism is based on antagonism, right? Enmity towards between groups. Religious groups is what we're seeing now. We see Islam. And not Islam, but people, Muslims, are very angry. And not just Muslims, some people from these countries, Muslim countries in general, are very angry, angry at Christians, angry at Americans. There have been religious wars going back centuries, millennia maybe. Angry against Jews. And then you have the other way, you know, the Americans are, and many Europeans, Canadians, have anger and antagonism towards Muslims, towards people who come from Muslim countries, regardless of whether they're Muslim or not. So we have racism. We have whatever it is to be prejudiced against another person's religion. This is all reactions, right? We have going back generations, this bad blood, where we can't stop this cycle. People from with these religious or cultural or ethnic backgrounds are fighting with each other, white against black, against brown, against red, yellow, Muslim against Christian, against Jew, Buddhist against Hindu. We haven't learned to just be. We haven't learned objectivity. We haven't learned to experience life without reacting, without judging, without building up these prejudices and these cruel intentions. So the real solution, I mean, it bears repeating that suffering comes from our reactions, not from our experiences. If we could learn to just experience things as they are, we'd let go of them. We wouldn't cling. We'd fly away, leave all of our suffering behind. And then whatever happened. I have two other stories. The first one is about these monks who went off into the forest to practice meditation. And the angels up in the trees had to come down. They were Buddhist, I guess, or they were probably not Buddhist, but they would have been respectful towards recluses. And when the monks went into the forest, the angels thought, "Oh, we have to come down from the trees." They were tree angels or sprites or whatever. And they had to leave their homes up in the trees because, out of respect for the monks, out of respect for these recluses, I guess. It's a some sort of, maybe it was because Indra had instituted from the high heavens, because he was Buddhist. Maybe he had said, "Well, you have to, if the monks go into the forest, it's a law in the angel world," maybe, I don't know. But they came down and it kind of irked them, and they weren't really happy about it. So they thought, "Well, what can we do to get these monks to leave our area?" And so all day and night they cultivated fear. They sent these visions to the monks of headless bodies and bodiless heads, and gruesome ghosts and apparitions of all sorts and sounds and so on. And the monks were unable to focus. They were totally out of their minds, freaking out, and they said, "We can't stay here." And so they went back to the Buddha. And the Buddha said to them, "Oh, well, the first time you went to the forest, you didn't have a weapon. A weapon to fight this terror. This terrorism. This is a good example of Buddhist terrorism. It's mild, I know. There was no. Although there was some sort of significant. Can you imagine one of those being in a horror film with these terrible visions?" They didn't know what was going on. They thought these were actually demons maybe out to get them. And the Buddha said, "Well, you need a weapon to fight this." And he taught them what we call the Karaniya Metta Sutta. Karaniya Metta Sutta. He said, "Go back, and as you walk into the forest, chant this." And so they chanted the loving kindness, the Sutta on loving kindness. Karaniya Metta Kusalena Yattang Yantang Santang Patang Abhisamecha Sako Jujasu Jujasu Achoja San Sujujasu Achoja. Let's see. All right. Suvachoja. Have to chant it. And on and on. Sabbe Sattva Bhavantu Sukhitata. May all beings be happy in their minds. Which speaks of one sort of conventional way of dealing with antagonism, dealing with enmity. A good way to change reactions is to apply the opposite. When confronted by hate, reply with love. It's conventional. It's not a deep Buddhist teaching, but it is a Buddhist teaching. That when you supplant something with its opposite, you are able to change the course of events. It takes work, it takes effort, it's not something that's sustainable over the long term, it takes effort to constantly have a loving attitude when when people are throwing hate at you. But it worked. These monks, what they did is they taught. It was a teaching. It wasn't just sending love to these angels. They were chanting it, and it was a reminder. A reminder of the suffering that comes from these bad intentions. The intent to cause fear. Really, the best way we can help, defeat our enemies is to give them what is most precious. If you give them knowledge and wisdom, give them truth. The other example, it's a very small sort of insignificant example, but it speaks to the larger picture of the context of these acts. It's I think there's more than one actually. There's examples of Mara. So the monks would be sitting in meditation, and suddenly an ox would come along and walk up near where the bowls, their ceramic bowls, were stacked. And the monks would freak out, try to, "Oh, we have to get up. There's this big ox coming. It's going to break all our bowls." So they all got agitated, and the Buddha said to them, "That's not an ox, that's Mara." Apparently, this happened several times in different ways. Mara would do anything he could to cause fear. And I only bring that, insignificant example up, and, who knows, it seems kind of a strange thing to happen, but to sort of think about what aspect of samsara we're talking about here. Fear is Mara's domain. Fear is part of this part of samsara, of those who delight in chaos, those who delight in suffering. There are angels, human beings, who are bent on this. And just to be clear that we don't want to be one of those people. We don't want to be involved with that part of samsara. It's a part of samsara that will probably always be around. Probably not something that's ever going to disappear completely. It might ebb and swell. But the universe is a big place. And so really our goal is to, well, the Buddha said, keep your minds calm, keep your minds set, keep your minds objective. So I bring it up as well because it's really an instruction to meditate, a reminder to us that many things will come to disturb our state of mind, both in meditation and out. And they're the problem. It's Mara. I think it's Mara. It's Satan. It's that part of samsara that wants to pull us back in, that doesn't want to see us free, doesn't want to see us happy, doesn't want to bring it to allow us peace. So our practice is to free ourselves from the hooks, from the grasp, free ourselves from the vulnerability to these forces, forces of Mara, and to help others. I mean, the best way we can help, we can overcome terrorists is by freeing them from the need, helping them be free from this need to torture others and thereby harm themselves and corrupt their own mind, sentence themselves to great suffering. There you go. Just some thoughts on fear, terror, terrorism. I think are somewhat apropos. There's the Dhamma for tonight. Thank you all for tuning in. May you all be free from fear. So are there any questions? This a question? Are you all just spamming me here? What's going on? Oh, here's a question. Is it true that you will never gain insight into the nature of reality unless you're either on retreat or keeping the seventh precept? You don't even have to keep the five precepts. You don't have to keep any precepts to gain insight. Precepts are fence posts. They don't do anything. Just because, poof, I'm keeping the precepts doesn't mean I'm wise or going to become enlightened. The Eightfold Noble Path is right action, right speech, right livelihood. That's the morality. And those are all mind states. They have nothing actually to do with action or speech. It's the intention to, or it's the aspect of the path that makes you disinclined to kill or steal or so on. Anyone who says whatever this person is saying is wrong, most definitely wrong. Yeah, you think of Bimbisara becoming a Sotapanna when he met the Buddha. This was the king, decked out in all his finery, came to see the Buddha. Or Santati was this guy who was drunk, and he went to see the Buddha. I don't know if he was still drunk. He probably sobered up a little bit, but he had been watching this woman dance all week. He'd been watching dancing all week, and then he becomes an arahant. I don't know, these are stories, you believe them or not, but there's certainly no sense that we need to keep all the precepts. Could you give a teaching on the cognitive and emotional obscuration in regards to all notable phenomena and knowable persons? That makes my brain hurt. I have no idea what that person is saying. So, what is it that's stopping us from knowing things? Cognitive and emotional obscuration. So, defilements that are stopping us from knowing everything? I don't know what you want me to talk about. Yeah, I mean, there's no question that entertainment's a problem. It's quite clear, but to suggest that you can't gain insight just because of it. It's not true. It just makes it more difficult, less likely, more problematic. But it's much more about your state of mind. Someone can watch entertainment mindfully and become enlightened while watching dancing and listening to singing and so on. It's not about what you're doing, it's about your state of mind. Since the mind at the moment of death is so important, what should one do if they know they are about to be killed or die suddenly? Well, be very mindful, of course. That would be the best. Of course, by that time it's a little late. It's like saying, "Excuse me, could you hold off? I have to go and train myself in mindfulness first." So yes, it's true that the moment of death is very important, but the question is, what's going to condition it? Well, our whole lives, everything we've done to make us who we are is going to condition that moment. Besides that, of course, there are other things you can do, less effective, but have calm your mind with some kind of mindfulness of the Buddha would be useful. Metta meditation, of course, would be useful. Would you say that the 40 kamatanas are special as opposed to focusing on worldly objects like music and entertainment, as they rarely give rise to defilements? There's nothing that special about the 40, but most of the 40. Some of them are quite special. But like take the kasinas, there's no real reason why you couldn't pick a different color than are listed there. Obviously they've been chosen and selected for reasons. Some of them are very special. Mindfulness of the Buddha, the Dhamma Sangha, the four Brahma Viharas, the Dhatus, the Arupa Kamatanas are unique. I mean, they're fairly unique, a lot of them. But Samatha meditation is infinite. There's so many, any number of objects. Music would make a bad one, of course. Entertainment would make a bad one. I mean, none of those could really bring Samatha, you're talking about the 40 kamatanas bring samatha. Well, that has to be a single unchanging object. It has to be stable, satisfying, controllable. Music isn't that. Unless, maybe trance music or, electronic stuff or drum beats. They'd be helpful. Really boring music. Something like that. But sound can certainly be an object. You can enter into jhana based on sound. Okay, well, thank you all for coming out. Wish you have a good night. See you all next time.